Welcome to the Paranormal News Insider for September 29th, 2015. And this is episode number 234. And as always, this is your host, Dr. Brian D. Parsons. Well, this week's news includes death from above, Sasquatch on vacation, a merman captured, psychic pets, crop circles are fake, and sad and frustrating news out of the ghost world, plus much, much more, including conferences and conventions for the rest of the year. And this week's news is brought to you by the International College of Humanistic Science. ICHS focuses on providing affordable, self-paced, standalone certificate and certification courses in a variety of metaphysical, esoteric, mystical, paranormal, business, and practical life topics that all relate to the human condition. And ICHS now provides degree programs as well. Visit ICHSworld.org for more details. And the reason why I mentioned ICHS is that I'm developing a course for the E4 method that, if I were to concentrate a little bit more time on, I could get done fairly quickly. I'm about halfway done with it, and it's going to have a lot more information than just the book alone. The book is a short book. I meant for it to actually be a lot shorter than what it is, but it's about 80 pages. But the course that I'm designing will be able to teach you, or any group, from beginning to end, how to conduct the E4 method of client-based paranormal investigations. That being said, well, I'm glad I'm alive and well, and I'm glad everyone survived the super blood full moon spectacular extraordinaire that happened over the weekend. And I was also relieved to see that the seas didn't boil. There was no tsunamis. The earth wasn't torn apart, and all these other crazy things that people predicted were going to happen with this full moon. And I guess while we're on that subject, I guess the big comet that was supposed to strike the earth, according to NASA, last Friday must have been averted as well. Well, maybe Bruce Willis was shooting a reality show in space. Well, the comet was actually an asteroid, and there were actually 6 near-Earth flybys this week. And with the big one was supposed to wipe out the Earth, was flying at about 5 million miles away. So I think it kind of missed us a bit. I usually don't talk about viral media like that, but if I can bring some light to some facts, you bet your asteroids I'll be talking about it. And now let's jump into some paranormal news here. Top of the show, I mentioned a nice little lineup. And usually, hopefully I have a good solid 5 or 6 really good stories. And again, I don't take each and every story that pops up in the paranormal, because some of them are pretty obvious fakes or hoaxes, or they just don't really give us anything that's going to help understand any portion of the paranormal whatsoever, be it UFOs, ghosts, cryptozoology, Bigfoot, all these subjects. What I'm really looking for is something that's going to uncover something really, really interesting. That, and just like I mentioned, viral videos, there's a lot of viral videos or misinformation that gets passed around, and I feel it's my duty to investigate these and bring you the truth. And that's why this is the Paranormal News Insider. And jumping into cryptid news now, residents on the small island community of Alert Bay on Cameron Island, just off the northern coast of Vancouver Island, have reported strange sounds that they feel are the elusive Sasquatch. Many of the 1,500 residents are convinced that they share their island with at least one Sasquatch, and a few on the island have sighting stories to go with the recently acquired sounds. CTV News from Vancouver Island reports that renowned Sasquatch investigator John Bindernagle, will be investigating the island by talking to witnesses and looking for clues. Well, you can tell by the name and the way I pronounce it, I've never heard of the guy. So as far as renown, I'm not sure about that. But anyway, as far as the noise is concerned, the island is known to not have any moose, which was speculated to be the cause, deer, or any other large animals, and is even fairly devoid of small animals as well. All right, so some little facts here. It's my turn. Cameron Island is only 4 square kilometers. Now, to those of us in the United States, that means it's only about 1.5 square miles big. That sounds pretty big, but for comparison's sake, the island of Key West, if you've ever been there, is about 5 square miles, of which I can cover nearly a quarter of that in one day by foot without even trying. Epcot Center and Disney World again, if you've been there, is roughly half a square mile. So imagine three Epcot centers, and you'll realize it's a small world after all. Now, Disney World itself sits on 40 square miles of land, which would be nearly 27 Cameron Islands. Either way, it's really not that big. While the population density is small, with about 1,500 people on the island, over half of the island is developed, and only a couple of small areas of forest remains, one of which is where the sounds purportedly originated. And the two major areas of undeveloped land are not connected to each other. And so if there was a Sasquatch on the island, it would either have to take a canoe out around to get to the other wooded area or sneak very gingerly through the woods at night. Well, the biggest problem I have with the story is that there seems to be little interest in finding the actual source of the sound. It seems rather that the intent is proving that Sasquatch was the source, or that Sasquatch exists on this little teeny tiny island. Following around a Sasquatch hunter is not an objective search for the sound. I also find it highly unlikely that a breeding group of Sasquatch or any other decent-sized animal could survive any length of time undiscovered on such a small island, despite some of the rugged terrain and thick forest on the island. Well, on the other hand, Vancouver Island, which is about 12,400 square miles in size, has also had numerous reports of Sasquatch over the years, and has a lot more remote area with a lot less population density, and is just a quick swim away from Cormorant Island. Now, UFO news, a couple of interesting videos, and a big story broke over the weekend. A stunning revelation was given at the third International UFO Truth Magazine Conference at the Civic Hall in Holmfirth, West Yorkshire, England. Those English names are so hard to pronounce. David Clayton, a self-proclaimed expert on crop circles and animal mutilations, I guess that is, animal mutilations, as well as purported former Royal Air Force engineer, claims that England's security force, known as MI5, for Military Intelligence Section 5, was responsible for a majority of hoaxed crop circles from 1990s to today. Clayton states that the British intelligence agencies have paid people to create these fake crop circles in order to discredit real researchers who find crop circles that cannot be explained. Well, other ufologists at the event also feel that the authorities are quick to discredit crop circle research work and that the media ridicules their work. The Daily Express, a British tabloid magazine with a history of conspiracy theory-driven material, has supposedly contacted MI5 about the claims stated by Clayton. And so far, no response that I've heard of has been found. David Clayton was not on the list of speakers for the event, which did include Stanton Friedman, a big celebrity here in the United States as far as UFOs are concerned, and a host of other worldwide experts on various topics relating to purported extraterrestrial activity on Earth. Now, a little back history here on crop circle reports. Modern day crop circle reports can be traced back to 1937, although official reports go back to, unofficial reports would go back to 1678 with what is called the Mowing Devil woodcut pamphlet from Hertfordshire, England. I'm sure many people are familiar with that little drawing of this little devil thing going around in a circle cutting a crop circle. It's purported to be a crop circle, but nobody really knows. But people just kind of generalize that this is what it's describing. Now, a man in England back in early 1940s, named David Wood, claimed that he previously made fake circles in the United Kingdom using ropes. The term crop circle is attributed to longtime crop circle and anomalous researcher Colin Andrews. In 1991, Doug Bauer and David Shorley, known in crappie circles as Doug and Dave, claimed that they were responsible for a majority of crop circles prior to 1987, and over 200 of them from 1987 to 1991, when crop circle sightings began to boom and become even more popular than they are today. The duo created a circle in front of journalists and then brought in a seriologist, which is the name for a crop circle researcher, named Pat Delgado, Delgado claimed that these circles were legitimate and not fake. Well, one would think that this would be the end of the line for crop circles, as it was for Delgado, who actually quit the field shortly after that incident. However, after this announcement and worldwide attention to crop circles, there became a boom in crop circle formations that continued well into the 1990s. Bauer had visited Australia when he saw media reports of an impression in swampland that accompanied a UFO sighting. And once back in England, he convinced his friend Chorley to create fake crop circles on Friday pub night. Well, after Friday pub night, they had no intention of trying to get any attention. It was just kind of for fun. Again, it was after pub night. But in 1981, a circle that they created in Cheesefoot Hill that could be seen by people was created, and also created a major, major media push. The crop circle gained instant international attention. And as they continued to fabricate circles, an entire industry of investigators, experts, books, and other type of media was created around the belief driven by the fake circles. Now, once the pair heard word that the government was going to create an inquiry about these circles, they decided that they had enough fun and finally came clean. While neither man seemed to profit from these creations, with the exception of a few $1,000 their exclusive story got them on a reveal to Today newspaper, it was claimed at the time that they were part of a conspiracy involving MI5, although the pair dismissed the idea with a laugh. Neither one of them really show, even to this day, any signs of monetary gain. Even if they were commissioned by the government, their creation of fake circles helped generate a worldwide interest in the current culture of belief that exists today. So if it was a plan to discredit the crop circle phenomena, it pretty much backfired. And that's your crop circle history for today. Now, some UFO stories in the news right now. A UFO video from April still has MUFON baffled as to what is actually in the video. The Mutual UFO Network states that the video was shot with a phone, and the video shows a light zooming horizontally. The video was shot in Port Jefferson, New York, and Long Island. And many researchers feel this is merely a drone, and some suggest it could be a small plane or other human-controlled aircraft. But with the limited nature of the video, there seems to be little that can be done to measure the range or speed of the object. So that one remains unsolved at this time. And another UFO video that just cropped up a couple of days ago shows a UFO flying near One World Trade Center in New York City. As the camera zooms in, the object suddenly shoots away. Well, this video is more than likely a hoax. As the object zooms away, the camera shakes back and forth and zooms back out in the typical fashion of what I call shoot first, insert UFO later style of filming. It's hardly a believable move from shooting an object, looking into the light, and the object itself does not look very believable in physical terms. Now you can see the video of the Port Jefferson UFO video at the Paranormal News Insider Facebook page at facebook.com/ParanewsInsider. Now, one big story that was breaking at the time of the Paranormal News Insider last week was a very sad story that has obviously become very popular in the last week, and it's probably one of the saddest stories of the year, was the Mark Constantino story involving a murder-suicide that also took the life of his estranged wife, Debbie, and a roommate of hers named James Anderson. Now, the Constantinos had made appearances on Ghost Adventures and Paranormal Challenge reality shows and were a staple on these paracelab ghost convention scene. Now, the horrible tragedy aside, and I won't get into talking about the details, everything is available on all the stories that are available out there online. One thing that I noticed that really struck me was how the paranormal field reacted to this news. Now, these are regular, normal people. They have regular, normal lives outside of the paranormal. Just because this is what they did doesn't mean this is what their lives were. And a lot of people reacted kind of strangely to all this. a lot of people overreacted and said that he got what he deserved, and other people were just completely shocked. And many people who have, you know, met this couple felt that personal connection to them and were shocked when this happened. Although when the details of their rocky relationship and multiple arrests came to light, not many had much to say. You know, I get it that people feel this connection to people they've met once or twice or they know from TV shows or whatever, but are you really that close enough to get a sense of shock? Well, for me, I guess I say that because just 2 weeks ago, right down the street from where I live, there was a confrontation between a man and his son where the man killed his son and taunted police with his gun and was subsequently shot and killed. So, you know, that kind of takes away the shock factor for me, maybe. And it didn't really shock me when that happened. It was just shocking that it happened so close to home. And it's not something that really happens in this area. But it is what it is. People die all the time. And guns and violence are very prevalent in our society. Unfortunately, it's really perpetuated by the media more than ever. And but back to the story. For me, it was more shocking about some of the things that people were doing. And I guess while it was shocking, I wasn't surprised to find out that a ghost investigator made public that he was getting EVPs from the couple and was attempting to contact them, and even made numerous announcements about what he was doing, which to me was disgusting. And just a simple way to cash in on the sad events of someone else's personal lives. And I'm not going to divulge the name or the show that this person has, because that's, I'm not going to glorify that at all. How disgusting. Again, it was just horrible that people would try to exploit the story for their own personal gain. And again, these were people, not just ghost investigators. And you know, the more I thought about that, an intriguing observation from the angle of that particular story of somebody trying to gain EVPs from this sad story is that the person legitimized this attempt at communication by stating that, quote, everyone knows that the connection is far stronger just after a person passes than over time, unquote. Oh, really? I've been in the ghost field for about 20 years. I've never heard that theory. I've never heard anybody actually do any work on this theory. I've never heard EVPs that were more clear or more better from people who just died versus ones that were 20, 30, 40 years old. I don't know where the work has been done to validate this claim, or you know, what scientist has validated this EVP theory or hypotheses. So it's a little strange. And I guess I must have missed that in my parapsychology journal somewhere. And from my knowledge of ghosts, this is no more a fact than anything else in the paranormal field that deals with tools, technology, EVP, or anything else. It's this to me is just an assumption. And again, it's sad that people have to cash in on that. And again, it was shocking that the story was basically unfolding, coming out in the media, I guess, just as the Paranormal News Insider show was wrapping up. And producer CJ sent me the link and informed me of what happened. And it was a little, I guess it was shocking at first. No, you don't really expect to see people that you're aware of in the paranormal be involved in situations like that. But once the story unfolded, again, all came to light about the backgrounds of everything. And that's all I have to say on that story. Now, I don't normally like to cover stories that happened in the past, but this story is interesting because this is one that I guess I can say I have a personal connection to, and it is an intriguing thing, and it's something that people still talk about to this day, even though this is a about a 20-year-old story, well, 21-year-old story. But it recently, for some reason, just popped up in the paranormal news. And reading through it, I found it was pretty interesting and felt like I wanted to bring this to the Paranormal News Insider, if anything, for discussion, or if anything, to reminisce on this particular investigation or series of experiments, I should say. And this all took place back in 1994. A series of experiments involving dog telepathy with Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. Well, this story, for some strange reason, has resurfaced. Not sure why, but Sheldrick, who has a PhD in biochemistry from Cambridge University and studied philosophy and history of science at Harvard University, is known for his research on unexplained animal behavior as well as telepathy in various forms. Now, he conducted over 100 experiments with a terrier named JT, and these experiments were filmed and observed behavior that indicated that the dog knew when the owner was coming home. Now, even though he conducted 100 experiments, there's obviously people out there that don't believe in this type of phenomena. And a man named Dr. Richard Wiseman, who's a British psychologist and renowned debunker of all things paranormal, also conducted his own experiments with JT and came to the conclusion that it was random, despite getting similar data to Sheldrake. Now, I guess it was just all in the way that Wiseman interpreted his data versus the way that Sheldrake interpreted his data. Wiseman stated that despite the dog being near a window when the owner came home, it also did so about every 10 minutes. So, in his opinion, it was nothing more than a matter of coincidence. Well, Wiseman also stated that as time went on, the dog would become more anxious and would stay by the window for longer periods, which would lead the dog to be at the window longer just prior to the owner's return. I don't think Wiseman has ever owned a dog. Sheldrick stated that with his experiments, there was no anxiety shown, and JT was not staying at the window for longer periods of time just prior to the arrival of its owner. That's easy to debunk something if you don't believe in it, but I'm willing to bet that there are some dogs out there that have an uncanny ability to detect their owners at a distance. But there are also some observations we should consider about this. Now, thinking about it, obviously these experiments were done in controlled settings. It was a video and the dog was in the location by itself. There was no other person involved. Now, a lot of people that I've talked to about this phenomenon over the years have told me their particular stories. And usually this involves them being in the home but with their pet at the same time. Now, dogs are especially aware of human behavior. It's basically our body language. They can interpret our cues and signals very, very well. They're very in tune with their owners and can tell when we're happy, when we're sad, when we're angry, and a lot of other emotions. And they tend to seem to know more about us than we do ourselves at times. So if you know that another person is coming home, a lot of times you'll tip off your dog and let them become aware of the fact that you know that this other person's home. Now, there was a story that trying to remember, it was called Clever Hans. Now, Clever Hans was a horse that was thought to have psychic ability, and it was able to answer mathematical questions presented to it by its owner. It was able to basically stomp its hoof to solve questions, usually math questions. And the horse Clever Hans, which it was a German horse, that stunned crowds, and people could not figure this out. Even the owner himself, he stated he had no idea. He really, truly, honestly thought it was not a hoax. It wasn't a trick. He wasn't a con man. He truly, honestly believed that this animal had this special cognition. It was able to connect with the other side, or was just smart, or whatever it was. They had no true idea of what was going on. Now, this story took place in the early 1900s, and pretty much came to a conclusion in 1907 when a psychologist named Oscar Fungst, I believe is his name, he demonstrated that the horse was not actually solving mathematical equations or actually answering questions, but was able to answer based on observing the people around him, or it, I guess. So the horse was basically, you know, answering a question but stopping when the people felt that it should stop. So it's essentially following cues, or the body language involuntarily by the trainer. So we kind of stumped ourselves with this. And Clever Hans is a really interesting story. And it was one thing I thought of when I was reading about this story, or at least Richard Wiseman's attempt to discredit the story here. But, you know, in my own personal things that now kind of difficult for me to talk about, but my dog just recently passed away just over a month ago. She was very well in tune with myself and my wife, and she really got along with us both and kind of different levels, and she really understood our emotional state and was very attentive to us in many different ways. But I never really saw her be able to gauge when my wife was coming home, other than hearing the unique sound of her vehicle entering the driveway, which she was incredible as far as interpreting sounds. She knew the sound of two identical belts that I own, and she could tell my work belt between my personal belt, and even behind a closed door knew when I was getting dressed to go out, where she became more excited versus when I was getting dressed for work. Granted, getting dressed for work happens usually at similar times, but she never displayed any ability seemingly to judge when either one of us were coming home. But when I was a kid, we had a German Shepherd named Muffin. She had uncanny ability to know when my father was coming home. Never could really tell when my mom was coming home. She would open the door and come in, and the dog would bark and not know who it was. But prior to my father coming home, about 5 minutes till he would arrive, she would get up, no matter what she was doing, walk to the stairs and stand there and just sit. 5 minutes, not 20 minutes, not an hour, but about 5 minutes each and every time. And my father worked for the water company, so we never had any idea what time he was coming home. It wasn't, you know, clockwork. It wasn't when he gets off at 5, he's home at 5:30. He came home at various times, but it was always about 5 minutes. And I noted this because I was about 12 or 13. And at that time, I didn't have any interest or belief in the paranormal whatsoever. I just found it strange that she knew. And I questioned this for years. And when I finally got into the paranormal and learned about parapsychology and ESP and psychic animals and all these things, it hit me that I believe my dog did have this ability, because she was able to do this on her own. I didn't know that my father was coming home. It seemed like she knew more about what was going on than I did. And as a young teenager, you know, sometimes you get into mischief. And I did use her as a gauge to find out when my dad was coming home, if my mom wasn't home coming home. So I just really kind of connected to this story. And I thought it was interesting how both sides were fighting back and forth. And I do respect the work of Dr. Richard Wiseman. He's a very, very knowledgeable scientist that has debunked a lot of strange things out there and is a great scientist. But sometimes skepticism can cloud your judgment, just as being a true believer can cloud your judgment about events and things going on around us as far as the paranormal. So if you're on one end of the spectrum or the other, sometimes these things can kind of cloud your judgment. And right now, I just want to mention that you're listening to WCJV Digital Broadcasting from Youngstown, New York on the CJ Mars Radio Network. And this is the Paranormal News Insider with your host, Dr. Brian D. Parsons. And that's it for the ghost news. And I want to mention quickly here that coming up in, well, about in an hour and a half, is Paranormalities and Ponderings with host Frank Lee. And you can get a little bit more ghost information from his special guest, Bill Bean. It's going to be a good show. Don't miss it. After this show, you're going to get an hour break. Grab a snack. Get a drink, go to the bathroom, rest up, and then get your pen and pad back out and take some good notes. It's going to be a good show. Bill Bean's a great guy. Don't miss it. Now let's go to other news. This story, I wasn't going to include this next story, but it's so intriguing. It's so crazy. It's so out there. I had no choice. Despite it being, it's been out for since Saturday. I found out about it Sunday morning. Despite it being out for a few days, I've not been able to find any kind of conclusion to the story. And it's just so out there. And if you've not seen it, this is going to be interesting. This video showed up apparently late Saturday night on YouTube, of course. Where else would that be? Of a group of men, five men to be exact, in biohazard or protective suits that were lifting what is described as a merman up a hill toward a stretcher that awaited. Now, at the stretcher, there are two men in reflective gear that are not wearing hazmat suits. The video claims to be filmed in Poland and does show what appears to be a bottom half shaped of this person that is shaped like a merman. Well, mermaid. Well, I don't know. Maybe the politically correct thing would be merperson. I don't know. While the upper half does appear to be a man, you can see in some of the still photographs of some of the videos that are out there on YouTube. Well, I wondered if this was maybe a misinterpretation. So I started asking questions as I'm watching this video. If it's just a guy being carried in a blanket, why would there be five people carrying him? And why would they be wearing hazmat suits? Or even if they're just protective gear, why would they be wearing that? And the other question is, in this particular scenario, is why would the lower half be covered and the man's upper body be exposed? The hard part about the video is you barely get to see the upper body and the lower body as it's placed on the stretcher because the people are kind of in the way. In several versions of the video, this is not likely to be a merman, merperson, whatever. But the event never really, it doesn't really show enough detail. But the scene itself is just awe-inspiring, especially the initial video. But some of the more popular ones are kind of cropped and kind of grainy. But I do have a link to the original one that is at the Paranormal News Insider Facebook page. And again, facebook.com/ Paranews Insider. In part of the video, you can see that the man has a manicured beard, a tanned face, tanned arms, but also has a farmer's tan and a white chest compared to the tanned parts. Now, this is not really ideal for someone who would spend all day swimming around. Not to mention the torso looks like a regular person. And if a mermaid, I'm sorry, merman, or I don't know, maybe the political correct merperson, I don't know which one to use here, were real, I doubt it would be like what we envisioned from the movies. You know, with a regular body with a fish tail or a fish torso down to the little fins there. And this brings up another observation. Maybe this was taken from a movie or television show set. This is something that a lot of people have said. Well, the real problem with this is that there's no cameras. There's no boom operators. There's no other crew members anywhere in the wide shot. And to film from so far away would make little sense, even for one take, which again, if you know anything about movies, they will generally shoot the same scene from various angles, various distances, just to get an overall view of a particular scene. They're not going to shoot it from one individual angle. Granted, we only see, in all actuality, a minute and 28 seconds of the actual scene itself, although there are videos that are almost 3 minutes long. They kind of repeat certain parts and freeze frame, showing individual portions of the video that they've copied, or of parts of the original video that were kind of confusing at first, because I couldn't understand where they got some of these still video or still pieces from until I found the original video. Again, my initial guess was that this video was I thought maybe either a living or dead person being removed from a lake or a river. But the photograph of the torso clearly shows someone who is alive. because they're not blue from death. We're showing signs of being in the water, decomposition, essentially. And a dead body would probably be removed in a body bag, not half exposed. But then again, why were they wearing these suits? So I'm really stumped at the real explanation of this. None of this really makes any sense. The still photograph that appears in one of the videos is one of four still video, still kind of photographs. It's really just screen captures. That one appears to be taken after the video of the body is moved away from the initial loading location. The first still photograph appears to be when the object is initially lifted up, where you can see what looks like a tail hanging down. The second is when the body is getting ready to be set on a stretcher, and you can see a white body and the dark area, obviously, below the waist. The third is a second later when the person is actually set onto the stretcher, and you can see what appears to be a human-like hand. Now, during the video, the copies of the video and the original video, which is very clear, by the way, you don't really see any movement of the person's hand, although the camera is kind of moving all over the place. So hopefully, if we can get a kind of a stabilized video, we can see whether or not this person's actually alive by movement, or if maybe they're just unconscious. It'd be kind of hard to tell, but you can pretty much tell that they're not dead based on the color of the body. And the body is pretty fluid in its movement, so there's no rigor mortis. Originally, when I saw the video, it looked like to be a cell phone video. But seeing the original video, it looks much clearer. And again, all these videos were uploaded September 26th. And the story that I found that included pretty much the original video, that came out on September 27th, on Sunday morning. Unfortunately, as far as YouTube is concerned, there seems to be a kind of a new trend for YouTube, and especially bloggers. They like to fabricate videos and stories essentially for clicks and ad views. So they're making money on every time somebody clicks on these stories. So as these stories climb into the hundreds of thousands or millions, somebody's making money. And when somebody copies these videos, they can also make money. And there are certain ways that people can make money by helping other people make money, by helping other people make money. So it's kind of a sad trend where people are just really out for click-throughs and ad views. But I'll tell you what, when I saw the pretty much what I call the original version, which is was shown on a British tabloid called Daily Star, showed a full 1 minute and 28 second video that shows that despite most of the YouTube video claims that it's a lake in Poland. Now, if you see the original video, it's obviously a river, and it's not a very deep river. So that kind of debunks the whole merman situation, because I don't see how a person could swim in water like that. But again, what is going on in the video? That's really what I want to know. It's not a question of whether it's a merman or a mermaid or a merperson or not. It's what the heck is going on? And not only is this a river, but it also appears to be shot at a park. Now you can hear cars in the background. So I'm thinking this person may be on a bridge or other observation area. So this is kind of like out in the open. So if this was such a hush-hush thing, and a merperson being taken out of the water, you'd think that it would be covered up a little bit more. Or they would be pointing to a person would probably be pretty obvious filming this from a distance. You'd think that they would point at this person or send somebody up to confiscate the video or whatever. But that doesn't seem to be the case. Now, again, the YouTube videos that are out there seem to be a little bit more close-cropped and grainy. They don't show the river. They don't show the park. Now, that kind of, to me, points toward a hoax or more or less fabrication. But like I said, the full video shows more footage of the men, which raises even more questions about what the heck is going on. And it just doesn't make sense whether it has to be staged, but who would go through such an elaborate prank to buy five suits which can't be cheap, even if they are just for painting, or you know, if they're not hazmat suits, it's not cheap to do to buy five of these things. And then you have two emergency personnel wearing a bright green vest, and there's a gurney there to carry, or a stretcher there to carry the person away. It's looks like new equipment. Rather strange. Why the elaborate hoax? And it's really not proving anything. It's not validating anything. And again, it doesn't appear to be a movie or TV show. And the Aquaman movie that's supposedly coming out in 2018 hasn't even started filming yet. So it's not that. You know, maybe it is a viral video for something. Unfortunately, we're just going to have to wait and see how this story pans out. Now, I was going to do a book of the week, but you know what? I kind of hem and hawed about which book of the week to pick. I had a few of them, from obscure books to somewhat popular books. You know, I'm just going to grab one here. We're just going to do this anyway. Book of the week, I think, is a great educational piece. It's a great way to help continue people's education in the paranormal, and to continue to help, obviously, educate on simple concepts, whether it's UFOs, ghosts, or anything else. Now, the reason why I had such a hard time determining a book of the week this week was there were so many different stories from so many different angles, from UFOs to Sasquatch to mermen or merpersons or whatever, that it really didn't seem to focus on any particular theme this week. Now, sometimes it seems like stories come out in themes. There'll be a lot of UFO stories or a lot of Sasquatch, Bigfoot stories, or, you know, just different stories that all kind of combine together. But this week, it was just kind of all over the place. But this week, I'm going to talk about Lloyd Auerbach. Now, Lloyd Auerbach has published a lot of books in his day. One of which was one of the first books that I really fell in love with. It was called ESP Hauntings and Poltergeists, a Parapsychologist's Handbook. Now, that one is, you'd be really hard-pressed to find it. It was out of print for a long time. It's actually from, I'm going to guess and say 1986, not that long ago, but as far as modern books are concerned, that's pretty old. But for me, it was one of the best books I'd read, and it was really called a Bible for parapsychologists. And for me, it was a book that I carried around a lot, and it was a really came in handy, and it was a book that I really enjoyed, and I got in the library a number of times until I couldn't actually buy a copy, and it came back into print, I'm trying to remember here, in the mid-1990s, but again, I didn't get a copy of it. But ultimately, talking with Lloyd, I actually got a copy of it on disc, which made my day, and it's still something I read every now and again. And recently, Lloyd published a series of books, three books for the most part, recently. One of them was called Hauntings and Poltergeists. One was called Ghost Hunting, How to Investigate the Paranormal, and another was called a Paranormal Casebook, Ghost Hunting in the New Millennium. Now, those all three books kind of hovered around the same kind of information, but really and truly, if I had to pick one of my favorites of those three new books, I would have to say Ghost Hunting, How to Investigate the Paranormal is a very good book. And it's really hard when you're somebody who has an extreme amount of knowledge in a subject to kind of water it down to present it to a general audience. And Lloyd has done a fantastic job of conveying this information to a generalized audience. And this book is one that I've recommended to any investigator that's joined my team since this book came out in 2008. And I still highly recommend this book for anybody getting into the paranormal field or even has been around for a while. This does talk a lot about parapsychology, obviously, since that's Lloyd's background. Over 35 years in the paranormal, with education and field investigation. Lloyd's been around. He's seen it, done it, been a part of it. And his knowledge, again, he could be really overly technical if he wanted to be, but he really provides really good basic information, straightforward, to the point, and put together in a very, very good format in this book. And he goes from parapsychology and discusses ESP and PK, extrasensory perception and psychokinesis, and then goes into the survival hypotheses, poltergeist, hauntings, apparitions, just some of the basic things that you need to know as an investigator. Now, he kind of goes through a kind of a mock scenarios, or how you would approach a case from the initial call to assessing what's going on, with interviewing people, looking for fraud, dealing with psychics, using the tools and technology. And he kind of really brings to light some of the misinformation that's out there, but is not overly focused on debunking the tools and technology. Now, he does actually go into how to resolve some of these situations, dealing with apparitions, dealing with hauntings, and how to deal with different things. And it's really, again, it's a really fantastic book for those that are interested in becoming a part of the field, or those that are in ghost investigation. I want to learn a little bit more about the parapsychology angle of investigating the paranormal. Unfortunately, most people have a ghost hunting version of investigating the paranormal and don't really use too much in the way of understanding what parapsychology is or how it can be applied to field investigations. Although, really, to break down parapsychology, it's not really field work. Parapsychology is more or less laboratory work. It's not really field work, and you can use that knowledge to use in the field, and as long as you have an understanding of how ESP, PK, and survival studies work, it makes it a lot easier for you to understand how to explain it to other people, as well as how to interpret what may or may not be going on around you. And again, he does provide some logical things, logical explanations as to what's going on. So, Ghost Hunting, How to Investigate the Paranormal by Lloyd Auerbach is our book of the week. Now, conferences, conventions, and other paranormal gatherings. Yes, Lloyd is a great teacher. I've taken a number of courses through him, telephone conferences, and, you know, he was one of the first people, one of the first big people that I reached out to as far as knowledge when I first started out. You know, there's a lot of other ghost teams, but they seemed a little disjointed from what I started to learn. And again, I learned about the paranormal through psychical research and through parapsychology. It was my first taste of what was going on, because I was researching a local urban legend, and I stumbled upon psychical research and the subject of parapsychology. So I got my feet wet in this paranormal investigation type of avenue by looking through the eyes of a parapsychologist. So he was one person that I had to reach out to, and amazingly, he emailed me back like within an hour, and I was just blown away by that, and even gave me his phone number to call him up and have a conversation. And granted, that was before the days of 2004, when ghost hunters came out and groups came out of the woodwork like crazy, but it was a little smaller world back at that point, but still great that somebody like that, of where he was, his standing in the field was still pretty high, to take time out for some unknown guy to have a question about it. And it is spelled correctly in the chat room. It's Lloyd Auerbach. It's one L. Some people use two L's, but it's one L. LloydAuerbach. Lloyd Auerbach. A lot of people do, unfortunately, spell it incorrectly. And again, he has a number of books. I think I've got pretty much all of them here, except for his latest one, ESP Wars East and West. I do have Mind Over Matter, a paranormal casebook, Hauntings and Poltergeists, ESP Hauntings and Poltergeists, Psychic Dreaming, Reincarnation, Channeling and Possession, and the one I just mentioned, Ghost Hunting, How to Investigate the Paranormal. So, that being said, we'll spend the last few minutes here talking about some of the conferences and conventions that are coming up, and a lot of these are winding down. It's almost October. You'd think there'd be a ton of them coming up, but a majority of these take place seemingly from, I would say, April through July. I guess August was a pretty deep year or a deep month this year, but I guess just so many people are busy in October in the paranormal. I know for me, it's a silly season, is what I call it. Involved in a number of interviews that you don't normally get outside of the paranormal. Media requests, library appearances, things like that usually happen for a lot of us that are in the field. So maybe they just kind of look at it that way and saying that probably the people that are really into it are going to be busy, or I don't know. That's just my theory here. But a few events coming up. This weekend is the Paradigm Symposium. Well, it was supposed to take place October 1st through the 4th in Bloomington, Minnesota. But checking on the event today, I found out that the symposium has been rescheduled for May or June of next year, 2016. So not sure what's going on with that. A lot of big name people were involved in this one. Travis Walton, Tom Fusco, Mika Hanks, Rita Louise, Scotty Roberts, Nick Redfern. Some pretty big names were involved with this symposium. Not sure what happened. Didn't really have a lot of time to dig into why it was postponed. But they say, hold on to your tickets. It's going to take place next year. Again, it was supposed to take place October 1st through the 4th in Bloomington, Minnesota, but again, has been rescheduled for next year. The following weekend, October 10th, is the East Coast Paracon in Pittstown Township in Pennsylvania. It's kind of close to me, I guess, but I don't think I'm going to that one. ShadowCon 2015, October 16th through the 17th in Fort Wayne, Indiana. That's going to be a big one. Lots of big name people going to that one as well. Little Traverse Bay Parafest 2015, October 16th and 17th in Bayview, Michigan. And the Port Gamble Ghost Conference, October 23rd through the 25th, 2015 in Port Gamble, Washington. And an event for me coming up, I'll be at the Westerville Public Library in Westerville, Ohio. That's just northeast of Columbus. Heard word last week that the event has been sold out, and they're putting basically standby seating. There's already almost 24 people on standby already just to get into the event. But you know what? If you want to go, just go. Just show up. We'll let you in. Standing room only. I'm cool. I don't mind talking to a huge group of people. It's going to be a lot of fun. This is my 7th consecutive year doing this particular event, and it's always a lot of fun. We have fun. I love this library, and one of my traditions is going upstairs when I first go in and looking at my books. This is the only library that I know of, at least in the state of Ohio, that has my books on file. I donated most of those, but recently they started ordering them for me. So it's really exciting that I'm part of the library system there, and am able to contribute some knowledge and education, at least to that local area, on a continuing basis, not only with the books, but by live events such as this. So if you're in the Westerville, Ohio area, anywhere near Columbus, I'll see you there. You better be there. October 26th in Westerville, Ohio. That's from 7 to 8:30 p.m. or whenever we get locked out. And the only other Paracon I see on the list for ghosts is the Old Mill Parafest, November 7th in Dundee, Michigan. And that's going to conclude 2015 for that, for the ghost section. Now, in UFOs, MUFON, I think I've mentioned this in the past, MUFON typically puts on the majority of the UFO events. There's random ones throughout the year, but MUFON tends to put on the largest amount of these. There is one, the first annual Fayette County PA UFO, Bigfoot, and Paranormal Expo. I guess that's the official name. That takes place October 17th in Fayette County, PA. So if you're in the area of that, that's an interesting one to go see as well. Mysteries of Space and Sky 2015 takes place October 24th in Gambrills, Maryland. The Pittsburgh 2015 MUFON Conference takes place November 14th in Youngwood, Pennsylvania. And I know there's a whole list of other MUFON conferences. I do provide a link on the ParanewsInsider.com events page, and you can find that obviously by going to ParanewsInsider.com and clicking on the events tab at the top. There is a link there for MUFON Find a Chapter page. If you find your state with this link, you can find out whether or not your state is having a meeting by clicking that state and finding the website for your particular state. And typically they'll show the conference information for that local state right there. Here in Ohio, I'm kind of in between Cleveland and Akron. We also have the Cleveland Ufology Project out of Cleveland. They have monthly meetings that talks about UFOs and things like that. But MUFON is nationwide. It's actually international. And if you want to go to one of their events, you can click on that. Now, not every state seems to have a web page, but bear with it. They may be adding one at any point in time. Now, cryptozoology, only a small handful of events there as well. As I mentioned earlier, the first annual Fayette County PA UFO, Bigfoot, and Paranormal Expo takes place October 17th. That event, well, obviously it's UFO, Bigfoot, and Paranormal. A lot of these have different things going on with them, not just one thing or the other. And it seems like UFOs and Bigfoot seem to go hand in hand at these kind of events. This is kind of a small event here. I was going to go to this one, but I don't think I'm going to be able to go. Stan Gordon, who's really, really super popular. He's kind of a researcher and investigator guru here in Ohio and Pennsylvania. He's by far one of the best researchers I've ever met, and that says a lot. He'll be the keynote speaker. John Ventry, the PA MUFON director. Fred Saluga, UFO and Bigfoot expert. He's also the West Virginia MUFON director. Great guy. We'll also be speaking, and a number of other people. Dave Dragason from the PA Bigfoot Society, which I'm a member of, will also be in attendance. They're going to be showing some documentaries, one on the Kecksburg UFO incident and Mountain Devil, on a local story involving Bigfoot. That's going to be a fun event. You know, I may try to go to that. I don't know. We'll see. If I do, I'll let you know how it goes. Also on the docket here, we have the third annual Boggy Creek Festival that takes place October 23rd through the 25th in Fauk, Arkansas, where it all took place. If you've ever seen the legend of Boggy Creek, it's based on this creature here in the Boggy Creek Festival. It's going to be interesting. I don't remember the first and second one, but nonetheless, I have the link to the third one. If you're in the Fauk, Arkansas area, or pretty much eastern Texas, I shouldn't have too hard of a time getting there. And already have one for 2016, the International Cryptozoology Museum Conference that takes place January 4th through the 6th in 2016 in St. Augustine, Florida. Love to go to that one, but probably more than likely not going to happen. Anyway, if you have any information about any event and would like to hear it here as well as see it on the website, let me know. Email me at insider at paranewsinsider.com. That's insider at paranewsinsider.com. Or you can go to paranewsinsider.com and click on the about/contact link at the top and get a hold of me. Let me know what's going on in your area, what you know. Help me out here. I'm here to communicate these events to you and to get them out there, but I need your help. I can't do it all by myself, guys. And I'm very generous to whenever anybody gives me any information, I'll gladly pass anything on that you want me to pass on. And that about does it for the Paranormal News Insider Hope you learned something tonight. And again, stay tuned for Paranormalities and Ponderings with host Frank Lee and guest Bill Bean. It's going to be fun. And with that, don't stop believing. This is your host, Dr. Brian D. Parsons, reporting.
Listening to WCJV Digital Broadcasting, Youngstown, New York, the CJ Mars Radio Network.